You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings on this Monday morning. I hope you had a good Veterans Day weekend. We are all thinking of our veterans this weekend and remain very grateful, as I'm sure you all are too, for what they've done for our country. And today we're going to talk about some other issues that concern today's military and the men and women who are making it up, who are working so hard to protect us, several of whom are on stage with us today, and to talk about the topic of military readiness. My name is Mike O'Hanlon in the Foreign Policy Program. I have, as I say, three commanders and colonels to my immediate left who are here as mid-career fellows, still in their respective services. And then at the end, two defense officials who are currently in a more academic mode but have helped run the Pentagon in a civilian manner in the past. And I will go down the row in just a second. But let me first explain the general concept that we're trying to get at today. And by the way, looking forward to your participation in the second half of the conversation with your questions as well. What we would like to do is assess the state of contemporary American military readiness. And I think many of you are aware this is, as it often is, a hot potato issue in American politics and American defense policy. We've heard a lot of people who are very concerned that military readiness is poor. We've even heard people use phrases occasionally that harken back to the hollow force days of the 1970s when the post-Vietnam military, which was just en route to becoming a modern professional volunteer force, was in really terrible straits, both in terms of the morale of the force, the qualifications, frankly, of many of the individuals within it, and certainly the state of equipment and maintenance and training in the force. I think today's military is much better, but it's also much smaller. And it's been at war for 15 years in one manner or another, so there have been enormous strains. So I'll just put my cards on the table. I'm primarily going to play the role of moderator here. But while sharing a lot of the concerns that readiness has severe problems and strains, I also think we don't want to overstate the problem, because if we do make readiness our main focus or even our predominant focus in American defense policy, I worry that other things that are equally important will get less attention, like long-term innovation and modernization. So it's really the effort to strike that correct balance that we're after today. And that's why I think it's so useful to have people who just last year were actually commanding units in the field or in very recent jobs, depending on which one we're talking about. And I'll invite each of our commanders and colonels in a second here to explain a little bit about their own background. I'll just give a very, very short summary of each. But they're going to be able to give us a little bit of granularity about what they saw in their jobs. Not just the big picture view of overall Department of Defense readiness, but specifically what they were doing, what they saw, what concerns they have. Immediately to my left is Dan Keeler, Commander Dan Keeler of the U.S. Navy. A helicopter pilot was deployed with his helicopter squadron that he commanded just last year, and certainly has, I know very well, a lot of concerns about the state of naval aviation, but more generally, Navy readiness. And we know that's been a concern with the collisions of two Navy ships in the past year as well, and we're asking a lot of our sailors, and Dan will be able to speak to what he sees as readiness issues there. By the way, we're going to begin by trying to diagnose and assess readiness in the first round of questions, and then we're going to go through a second round to say what should we do about it. So that's the very simple structure to the conversation before we then go to you later on. To Dan's left is Colonel Tim Hayden, U.S. Army. Tim had the extremely important job last year of commanding the brigade that was deployed to Korea. As you know, we have really just one brigade, one Army brigade in Korea at a time. It rotates in and out. It's a different brigade each 9 months, I believe. And Tim prepared that brigade here in the United States and then took it to Korea where he commanded it. So he had a bird's eye view of readiness on the front lines, as did Dan. Both Dan and Tim have seen operational forces in just the last year that were really at the tip of the spear. And that's no less true for Kate Higgins-Bloom, who is our Coast Guard fellow. As you know, the Coast Guard is a military service of the United States, but it is not within the Department of Defense budget world. It is within the Department of Homeland Security budget world, and it's also a far smaller service with a far smaller budget but arguably just as wide a range, if not even wider in some ways, of a portfolio of responsibilities because, as Kate Higgins-Bloom can tell you, the Coast Guard does a lot of things overseas as well as here at home and in our home waters. And certainly the Coast Guard has been asked to do a great deal with very limited resources, so readiness is a relevant question there as well. Mara Carlin, just to Kate's left, was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development in the Obama administration until just recently, until last winter. And so in addition to wrestling with all the readiness challenges, Mara is a person who's got to think about what's the broader set of concerns for the Department of Defense going forward. And in an era of cyber threats and artificial intelligence arising on the horizon and robotics and other modernization requirements and innovation requirements, the question is, how do we find a way to walk and chew gum at the same time, to address near-term readiness without losing sight of the need for longer-term force development and improvement? And so certainly Mara has seen that question up close. And then finally, at the end, Sandy Apgar, who has 55 years of service to this nation's military in one way or another, including notably as the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations in the Clinton years, but also he brings to the table a great deal of private sector expertise, and he's going to be a natural linchpin for our conversation as we start to think about how to deal with readiness challenges and how to make sure that we don't squander resources on the wrong kinds of military expenditure, to make sure that we guard our resources for readiness and other such requirements. So thank you for indulging me the chance to give a little bit of a lengthy introduction to the topic. And now I'm done for a while. I'm going to finally turn things over. Again, we're going to go down the row and just try to take a snapshot. And I've invited each panelist to be as specific as they wish or as broad as they wish or both. So I'm sure we'll hear about their individual units, but of course they also may speak more generally about conditions within their service or the Department of Defense writ large. Dan, without further ado, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. So as Mike mentioned, I just finished my command tour at HSC-4, which is a helicopter squadron and a carrier air wing. We deployed from January to June to the Pacific, basically South China Sea and Korea on the Carl Vinson. How's readiness right now? That air wing for that deployment was properly trained to do what we were doing. And I think that's an important kind of distinction. Readiness for what? And we were ready for that deployment. The impact, but it took a long time to get there. And in that air wing was not ready for a long time, up until basically right before we deployed. And now how did that happen? So I think there's been a lot written about the BCA, Budget Control Act of 2011, and continuing resolutions. That particular group of squadrons, there's eight squadrons in an air wing, had not deployed since 2011. They lost a deployment in 2012. They moved aircraft carriers. That was kind of planned. We bounced from the George Washington to the Ronald Reagan until eventually the Carl Vinson. But that group of eight squadrons did not deploy as a unit for almost 4 years. That has, based on the strategic decisions that Navy leadership and Department of Defense leadership has done, which is to fully fund deployed and next to deploy units, if you're on the bench, you don't get what you need right now. And we've been doing that for a long time to kind of manage what the CNO calls the triple whammy, which is budgetary uncertainty, high op tempo, and sequestration. Those things meant that if you were not in the next to deploy or deployed, you were not getting funded. So what did that do to my unit? We lost a deployment in 2012. I wasn't the XO yet, wasn't in my command tour, but it was the year before. You'd think that, hey, that makes everybody happy, right? We don't have to go to sea. We can spend more time with our families. That's true, but you also don't get the money. So it means you don't fly as a pilot. You don't get to go to schools as a mechanic because funding for schools is cut back. So when I arrived, my unit and, quite frankly, the other seven squadrons in that air wing, we were at the bare minimum. We were barely functioning. There's what in the Navy, naval aviation, we call tactical hard deck. As a pilot, you would like to fly as much as you can, but you feel comfortable around 20 hours a month. Tactical hard deck is 12 hours a month. So when I showed up to my squadron, we weren't even making that. Junior officers were probably flying around 10 hours a month. That's enough to That's not enough to really stay proficient. Now, so I show up, and now we finally get a scheduled deployment, a short one, the first year, my EXO tour, basically to take the George Washington to Norfolk, and that was very helpful, and that was kind of a gift. We argued for money to do that because normally an air wing doesn't have to be on board an aircraft carrier to go to South America, but we needed it. So that was helpful. And then gradually, and it took a long time, and it took more money probably than we normally would have needed to build readiness back up because we didn't have that 2012 deployment. And we made it. But to make it, we had to, unfortunately, we've been playing the shell game in naval aviation where to get to deploy last year, we had to more or less steal people and airplanes from other air wings that were now on the bench to make our deployment. And that is really unhealthy. So we call it cannibalization. When we talk about the aircraft, you're ripping people and mechanics out of one squadron, ripping a helicopter or a jet out of another squadron and putting it in an air wing to make so that the deploying unit is whole. That's not sustainable. If you follow the four-star, three-star testimony on the Hill, they've been telling people it's not sustainable. So, we can't keep doing it. The folks on the bench are just going to eventually not make it. How is readiness now? Well, it's getting better. In 2017, we argued for about just under $3 billion to add to the budget. Went straight into O&M or readiness accounts, and that was that helped. So I think my squadron, my old squadron, is deploying again in January in the Carl Vinson, and from talking to them, they're better. They're not as in the hole they were in when I started. And that's money. That is a pure function of money. And I think 2018, we've got another, roughly, they put another $3 billion into O&M accounts to kind of keep that going. And that's vitally necessary. So I would say, what's the readiness right now? It's improving, but it's very fragile. We're recovering. And if we continue, so December 8th is when the next CR runs out. There's this, debate on the Hill about, tax reform, about if the defense budget will even get approved. If we go back to the BCA caps, I'm afraid that we'll take another hit and that this fragile recovery would get broken.
Just one quick follow-up, Dan. Thank you. That was very helpful. You say that in 2017, an injection of additional money helped. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that in the previous years, a lack of money was the main culprit, or was it more the unpredictability of knowing when you'd get the money because of all the budgetary shenanigans in Washington?
It's a little bit of both. So when you don't have the money, so what... What my bosses were doing was basically fully funding flight hours, fully funding deploy to next deploy, and robbing the money from parts, things like that, so that the folks on the bench didn't have aircraft, didn't have all the people. So it made it difficult for them to maintain a baseline that you could then ramp up quickly to deploy. Does that make sense?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
So it's, and that is that. Gap is just getting bigger every year that you don't fully fund those accounts.
Thank you. Tim, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. And again, my name is Tim Hayden. I'm a colonel in the United States Army. And up until about mid-July of this summer, I commanded the 1st Brigade Combat Team, 1st Infantry Division. And we had just returned from a deployment to the Republic of Korea where we served as the Rotational Brigade Combat Team. Prior to that, about a year in the War College, and then just before that, I was the Operations Officer for the 1st Cavalry Division. So I've seen training and training readiness, the impacts of continuing resolutions on our readiness over the last 4 to 5 years, upfront and personal. My experience, granted, is at tactical level units. So I'll avoid some of the strategic readiness, which we could certainly bifurcate the readiness question to current operational readiness in our fighting formations and in our sustaining formations versus long-term strategic readiness. Do we have power projection? Do we have mobilization? And what I'd like to focus on is just the current readiness fight. I'm an optimist. I think I owe it to you to tell you that your Army has never been better trained, better led, and frankly, from where I sit, better resourced for the current fight. I can tell you for a fact, and I am biased, that the Brigade Combat Team returning home from Korea was far more lethal, far more capable, and an intangible element of readiness that we certainly can't put a dollar figure on is far more confident in their ability to accomplish their decisive action mission. So if we go back in time a little bit, and I deployed and took command under the last of the R4Gen model, which was discrete periods of readiness for a defined mission for a period of time. And we knew that because we had a program, we call it the patch chart, and so we allowed ourselves to man the deploying unit, resource them to the levels that they needed to be resourced to achieve their readiness goals for the mission that they were assigned. We have transitioned from R4Gen into what is now a sustained readiness model. And you may have heard it, the fight tonight, the fight anywhere, to go back to our decisive action, our full spectrum of military tasks. And in a brigade combat team, on any given moment in the fight, there's about 5,000 individual tasks and over 700 collective tasks being accomplished simultaneously, and that's very hard. So the business of readiness at the brigade combat team and brigade size formation and below is the hard work of good Army professionals. Now, my experience, and here's why I'm an optimist, is because about 2 years ago, we made this shift, both mentally as well as we started the physical transformation of our units. We reduced structure to allow ourselves to manner our fighting formations to a higher degree. We returned to our decisive action rotations at our national training centers to make sure that we gave our brigade combat teams and the supporting elements the full decisive action workup to prepare for any kind of threat. That way we had confidence in their ability should they be employed as such. But more importantly, what we've done is we have rebuilt the cadre of our junior, mid-grade, and senior leaders on the fundamentals of warfighting tasks that will allow us to continue this glide slope as we have our target goal of a full return to readiness in fiscal year 21 to 23. Right now, as we build our brigade combat teams, we know that about a third of them are ready to fight tonight, and that's by design. And we are incrementally building the bench. We are incrementally building the skill sets within our formations. And I think we are well underway to achieving that goal. So I'm an optimist on readiness. What I see in our formations is that we are getting the leaders when we need them. Would we like them a little sooner? Absolutely. Our number one challenge for readiness continues to remain personnel. And that's it's not a capability issue. It's a capacity issue. It's making sure that we have the right folks in the right numbers at the right time to accomplish the training and then to go on to our deployed missions or our home station support missions. And so I think it's easy to kind of wish away the readiness problem as a simple dollar figure. That briefs well, it carries a very good headline, but it's much more than just a dollar figure. It's having the right people at the right time to first affect the training and then to accomplish the mission. And then having sufficient inventory to where we don't continuously wear out the same population of soldiers and their families, frankly, over and over again. And with that, I think, Mike, I'll stop there in the interest of time.
A quick follow-up, though, for you, too, as well, Tim, because I'm very grateful for that and grateful for both the messages, which, you know, I don't see as contradictory. They're just two different parts of a much bigger story.
I think that's an important point. Every service is completely different and has different readiness challenges, and you're going to hit different answers.
And so as we try to make sense of what we hear in the policy debate, I'm not going to ask you to take anybody on by name, but there are people out there who say only 3 Army brigades are ready out of 58, if you count active and National Guard. What do they mean? Because you just said about a third are ready, but other people who perhaps are trying to drive home a point with emphasis say it's 3. How can you reconcile these two perspectives?
Also, thanks for the question, the follow-up. I'll speak from my experience. Just in the active Army, total Army, and we speak in a total Army, but in the active Army, we have 9 Armored Brigade combat teams. We're building out a 10th right now. And so currently 4 deployed. At any given time, we've got an Armored Brigade combat team in Korea, an Armored Brigade combat team in the Middle East, and an Armored Brigade combat team in Europe. Now, right now, as we transition, if you go back to the R4Gen and into the sustained readiness model, as we look at filling out our formations with the force structure and the equipment, it takes 3 to make 1. You've got 1 to deployed. You've got 1 in a train-up to relieve the on-station formation that's forward deployed, and then you've got 1 that's recovering. And those personnel will go to much-needed reset, schools, professional development, and we'll transfer some of those formations throughout the Army. What I think is key to note is that readiness is not something you can just apply a dollar figure to and you get readiness overnight. Readiness takes time to build. And the conscious decision we made about 2 years ago to return to a decisive action focus, a sustained readiness model to fight tonight, regardless of what the threat is, versus an R4Gen very specific mission, specific region, specific period of time. That has caused us to move through this kind of maturation of readiness. I think an important part also to note is the armor brigade combat teams that are deploying right now into the regional line force theaters come back better brigade combat teams. And we are not consuming readiness. We are actually building readiness because for the entire time you're there, you have the opportunity to conduct decisive action training. Everything from lower level marksmanship to task force size air assaults to combined arms training, shooting gunnery. So when we bring those formations back, we have not deployed them and consumed it, and we're starting from zero again. We're bringing those formations back at a very high state of readiness. And even if some of those individuals in the formation are PCS'd or change a duty station to another unit, what they're bringing with them is confidence. They're bringing with them experience. They're bringing knowledge of how to function in that kind of environment. And that is one of the intangible elements of readiness. It's the confidence that you conduct your wartime mission in austere environments.
Thank you. Very helpful. And for those of you who didn't recognize the acronym, R4GEN is Army Force Generation Model, which is sort of a detailed way of matching units with tasks in a sort of a day-to-day, month-to-month environment, as well as for the possibility of combat.
Essentially, for layman's purposes.
So now let me turn to Kate. And Kate, you just heard from two gentlemen, each of whose service has about $150 billion a year budget. I don't think yours does. So
not quite,
We'll take a slight break from the Department of Defense, but maybe here's some similar concerns, I'm guessing. Over to you.
Yes, absolutely. Definitely some similar concerns. And before we get started, I'm just going to have to mention that the Coast Guard's motto is Semper Paratus, which is always ready. So you can pretty much guess what my answer is going to be to this question. But So prior to coming to Brookings, I was the chief of the Coast Guard's command center for Hampton Roads, which more accurately could be described as Virginia, so from about 200 miles offshore all the way up the Chesapeake Bay. And we were the all-hazards response kind of first line. So whether it was rescuing fishermen off of the eastern shore or delivering a tactical boarding team for an intel queued interdiction, we did all of those things often within a 24-hour period of each other, and made sure the parade of sail was safe and accessible for all the recreational boaters. So a pretty complex mix of missions, and I think that's really one of the differences is we are not part of the Department of Defense. We are part of DHS, which has enabled us to use a very unique package of authorities, both as a federal law enforcement agency and a military service, to prosecute some of America's interests sort of in that gray zone, particularly as some of our neighbors in other countries such as China and Russia attempt to sort of change the status quo in places like the Arctic and the South China Sea. The Coast Guard has a unique set of capabilities and missions that we do that enable us to kind of operate there in a less restricted manner. So I will stick to kind of our defense readiness posture. If I tried to talk to you about all of the different missions that the Coast Guard does, it would be a really different session. So happy to talk with folks about that afterwards, though, if they're interested. But to give a sense of scale, there's about 40,000 active duty Coast Guard members. Budget's about $10 billion. And that's after our friends on the Hill restored some of our funding after the last round of budget. And overall, I would say that our state of readiness is decent. We can accomplish the missions that we have laid out, particularly maintaining our commitments to the combatant commanders. We have about 20 ships underway at any given time supporting PACOM, SOUTHCOM, and CENTCOM, as well as missions in AFRICOM. So fairly globally deployed in support of either capacity building or a lot of interdiction work. In any given year, the returns on investment are pretty huge. Our readiness challenge really does come from unpredictability and the need to recapitalize long-term. The Coast Guard is unique because it is both a capital asset-intensive service, like the Navy, and a people-intensive service, like the Army. And making that case to the Hill can sometimes be challenging because it sounds like we're talking out of both sides of our mouth, and really we're not. So the long-term issue is really where we are most concerned about readiness. We have cutters that are 50 years old. We have ships that were old when I was an ensign, which was a long time ago. That are still underway and are considered to be our high-end assets. The other challenge to readiness is just that the scope of the mission continues to increase without a real conversation about what the trade-offs are going to be. If we want to be more aggressive on, say, the maritime boundary line with Russia, where the Coast Guard has been for at least the last 30 years, that will cost you something somewhere else. Hurricane season this year was an excellent example. We were able to deploy helos from Alaska and Maine and Massachusetts down to Texas to rescue 12,000 people and divert cutters that were on counter-narcotics patrols to respond to Puerto Rico. The downside to that was that we also had to recategorize about 10% of our AC&I funding. So the capital investment money that we need to buy new cutters next year and the year after that went to this year's response. It also meant that if you were in distress off Alaska, there was one less helicopter to come out and get you. So that is really our readiness model, though. There is no bench. And it's something that I don't think is very clearly communicated to the public. And I know we're going to talk more about solutions, so I'll end here on gloom and doom. I think that there's a lot of really good things we can do in the future to improve our readiness. So I'd say right now, we're ready to do the mission that's in front of us, but most of us have concerns about the future.
Thank you, Kate. Excellent. And I think you really drove home a point that probably I should have made in my already too long introduction, but let me just make it now. When we're talking about readiness, we're largely looking at unit-by-unit preparedness, not really assessing whether the overall force structure is adequate to the plausible tasks at hand. Dan sort of hinted at this as well with the question, ready for what? But readiness, as we've been discussing it so far, is primarily a unit-by-unit thing. You could have good individual unit readiness, but have a military that's simply too small or improperly structured for the tasks that it may wind up having to confront. So I think one of the things I heard you say, Kate, when you talked about the modest size of the Coast Guard, which frankly isn't much bigger than it was before 9/11.
It's actually at its pre-9/11 size. So we had a slight peak and then...
And we all know that we're concerned about whether the Coast Guard and Navy have enough icebreaker assets, things like that. So you didn't even get into... I don't take your assessment as... when you say it's decent readiness in the Coast Guard, you aren't necessarily commenting on whether the Coast Guard is big enough or large enough or broad enough in its capabilities, right?
Correct. I mean, my frank personal assessment, speaking for myself and not the United States Coast Guard, although I think they would generally agree, is that we need more Coast Guard, and we need more Coast Guard pretty much everywhere, particularly things like the Arctic and the Pacific, where we just don't have the capacity. When we work for the COCOMs, I mean, the Pacific Area Commander routinely calls the Commandant of the Coast Guard asking for more Coast Guard, but we don't have any more to give. And one other point I'd like to associate myself very strongly with Tim's remarks, the more we do our job, the better we get at our job. Coast Guard cutters are underway about 200 to 220 days a year. During the course of a patrol, you will start out qualified, but not maybe as confident as you could be. After a few interdictions and a few rescues, that skill level goes up, and that's something that you cannot simulate. You can't train it in a classroom. It's really something that we get by being out on the water and doing our job.
Yeah, that point, I think, needs to be reinforced. We talk about size of force structure, regardless of service, it doesn't matter. To get bigger in any service, to grow the force structure, requires leaders who are very capable and competent in training that next generation. So the ability to get better at your job, the more you learn, the faster you learn, the faster you gain that return on investment. So whether we're at the right end strength right now or not could be debated ad nauseum. It's really about priorities and resources. But what we have to be, because we owe it to you as citizens and we owe it to the country, is we have to be very, very good at our jobs. With the resources that were provided. And I think that's one thing that you'll see consistently across the services is that regardless of funding levels, regardless of time, or each one of those leaders, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardmen will do their very best to give you the absolute best return on your readiness dollar.
So thank you. And now, Mara, if I could go to you. Among your jobs in the Obama administration, you had to help write the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review, which was wrestling with all the trade-offs within defense, a finite budget, finite amounts of time and energy for top policymakers and military leaders. And you had to think about readiness not only on its own terms, but in this broader context with possible trade-offs. So how would you assess readiness today and, you know, compare it to other defense needs more generally?
Great. Thanks so much, Mike. It's really a pleasure to be here, especially with such terrific fellow panelists. So when I think about readiness, I start off with three questions. Ready for what? Ready for one? And what's everyone else doing? So let me walk through those for a moment. Ready for what? Are we talking about a counterinsurgency fight? Are we talking about a high-end conventional fight? Are we talking about presence around different regions? Are we talking about an actual conflict, an actual war fight? Are we talking about the Middle East? Are we talking about Europe? Are we talking about the Asia Pacific? Oh, by the way, there's also the Western Hemisphere and Africa. What do we mean when we say ready for what? What is the type of conflict we are thinking about, or the type of challenge we're thinking about that we need the U.S. military to deploy and think about and deal with? So ready for when? Effectively, this is near-term, long-term. Is there a conflict happening tonight? Is there sort of a presence mission that's needed tonight? Or is this a longer-term conflict that one needs to worry about? And then finally, what about everyone else? Right? We generally do things jointly. So what's everyone else bringing to this challenge? And how might you think about them in a substitutive or complementary manner? You know, and as you're thinking about readiness, it's important to remember two key principles. The U.S. military likes to fight away games and likes to have unfair advantages. And we put those two principles on ourselves. You do not see that necessarily with militaries around the world. So the U.S. military has been at war for 16 years. And a lot's happened in those 16 years. You've had profound personnel costs. You've had real wear and tear, to put it lightly, on the materiel. And there's been an opportunity cost. When you look at the types of conflicts that the U.S. military has engaged in and compare it to what the U.S. military might need to engage in the future. Now, the readiness story today is really complicated. And you cannot look at it without understanding what's happened and what we've inherited from these last 16 years. It also differs profoundly by service, as folks were saying earlier. So instead of walking through each service, I think what I would emphasize is sort of the two areas that worry me the most: aviation and munitions. And the stories on those differ a little bit. So aviation, marine aviation should worry you a lot right now, if you've been following what's happening with the Marines over the last year or two. The Air Force, you know, what's interesting about the Air Force is that the readiness challenge doesn't start in 2001 or 2003 the way it does for the rest of the military. It actually starts way back in the 90s. Remember Operations Northern Watch and Southern Watch? So for the Air Force, 9/11, 03 Iraq War, et cetera, was just building on an already challenging aviation environment. And then munitions, of course. The types of munitions that we need for future conflicts are probably a little bit different for current conflicts. And oh, by the way, no one ever gets excited about munitions, right? No one ever sees it in their interest to step forward to Congress and say, I want to advocate for more munitions. They want to advocate for end strength. They want to advocate for more ships. But because munitions are a largely joint asset, they end up not being invested in to the degree we need, and you cannot surge them effectively. Why don't I wrap there? Thanks.
That's super. Thank you. On aviation, just to make sure that I understood one of your points, and thank you for the very excellent specificity. You mentioned the Marines in particular, but then you also talked about Air Force problems. Do you see them in a relatively common, acuteness, or do you think the Marine aviation problem is even more serious from what you've seen?
It's a really good question, Mike. Part of it depends on what you want from each of those services. So for the Marines, the challenge is that as they become the first with F-35, they've invariably had to take some risk on other parts of aviation. The Marines also have this wonderful tendency to say, we'll duct tape up the challenge and figure it out, which I think you could argue is pretty unique to the Marines compared to the other services. So for them, there was inevitably going to be a little bit of an imbalance as they went to F-35 and were the first to do so. But making sure the other parts of the aviation portfolio were balanced was really important. For the Air Force, it's probably a little bit more complicated. I mean, part of it is just that you've had, starting in the 90s onward, this sort of endless use of air assets. You also, frankly, have had a whole lot of examples where the Air Force is using the wrong asset for the wrong fight. So F-22s, F-35s against ISIS, Probably not, right? You probably would want to think about the type of platform you are using, and I understand, obviously, there are parochial reasons these are used, there are political reasons these are used, all sorts of discomfiting things. But at the end of the day, those are really expensive to operate, right? And to the extent you could have a low-end platform that you're using in these types of flights, excuse me, in these types of fights, you are not only probably going to be as effective, but you're also going to be in line with the resources that we need.
Thank you. Sandy, please feel free to comment on how you see readiness today, but also I'm hoping that we can now start the second phase of the conversation and invite you to begin that for us on how to make sense of all that we've heard and march forward. So to the extent that we have challenges within the Department of Defense, some of them constrained resources, some of them perhaps wasteful spending on DoD infrastructure, bases, installations, what kinds of reforms might allow us within a given amount of defense budget to be more focused on the training and readiness challenges because we're wasting less. So I think you're a great person to complete the snapshot of readiness, but also then launch into that policy discussion going forward, please.
We'll have to pick up that headline of wasting less. That's the first time I've heard anyone formulate part of the problem in that. Well, first, because no one else has mentioned it, and it has been my patch for quite a while, the message is to you all, infrastructure matters to readiness. What do we mean by infrastructure? Defense has a different definition from the civilian world and economy. In civilian life, we think of infrastructure as sewers, roads, trains, and utilities. In the Defense Department and the defense budget, infrastructure is essentially the physical environment that supports the warfighter and increasingly the electronic systems which enable that physical environment to work. It's a very broad definition, so broad that in budget terms it represents somewhere between 40 and 50% of the entire defense budget. But if you think of it in those terms, there are many levers to pull in both policy and operational terms. So three key points to take that forward. First, this physical environment accommodates people, operations, training, but it also enables service members to perform their roles wherever it may be. They're in pure management terms, there are two classes of infrastructure in defense in the military, which are critical to keep in mind. One is mobile, that is, people move around, units move, and they, in effect, carry their infrastructure with them wherever they go. We have made an enormous mistake in the last 50 years, in my personal view, in treating the mobile force as if it were permanent, and then applying a fixed infrastructure set of engineering and management and construction results to that, with the result that we do have and have consistently had for at least since the 1980s, 20 to 30% more infrastructure than we need. Now, you've all heard the multiple appeals of successive secretaries of defense and the department in trying to persuade Congress to enable further BRACs. And the reason it's so critical is because without those authorities, the services are very limited in tailoring their infrastructure to their needs, but also to the different environments in which we now face. We have an industrial era infrastructure for an electronic information-driven age and all that goes with those. Second point is that, as alluded to earlier for other parts of this readiness picture, installations are almost always the bill payers when there isn't any other money around. It's very easy to mortgage the future in real estate in general, your own personal house, and also defense infrastructure, and that happens every budget cycle, both those that I was involved in trying to negotiate and those that I've witnessed before and since. And that is no right way to run this business. At best, infrastructure can be an annual mobile result, literally knock down buildings and put tents, permanent tents up. But in general, these are 10 to 20 year, if not 30 to 50 year investments. And if you approach them on a purely annual budgeting basis, you don't recognize the long-term assets. You use them as bill payers because you're mortgaging them for the future. You're bound to have too much of the wrong thing in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that is the critical contrast between how the defense establishment writ large and American, and indeed global business works. Businesses are much more effective in tailoring their infrastructure needs, and they are significant as well, to the realities of their business, their competition, their operations. And that actually is the segue to the third point, which I think does begin to reach, Mike, to your pivot to conclusions, and that is that the private sector has much more to contribute than the current budget and policy structure allows. What do I mean by that? We all know that this economy is built on private enterprise. We believe in it. Not everyone else in the world does, but we do. And we also believe in and understand the capabilities, the ingenuity, as well as the technical, manufacturing, and operational capabilities of business. When defense looks at the business community, it tends to see means of execution, but it does not see the strategic, conceptual redefinition of how business is done that mark the best businesses of all types in all industries. And that has been most of my career. And the contrast that I see, if not every day, frequently, is that the best managed parts of DoD and the services are those which recognize that they're in partnerships with the business community, their business partners, and actually treat them as partners, not a them and us relationship, but a we relationship. That is, believe it or not, very hard to execute in the military establishment as a whole. Eisenhower did forecast this problem. We live it. I think I'll close there, Mike.
Excellent. Thank you. So now I think what we'll do is just work back towards me and ask each person to give a specific example or two of where you think that readiness problems, as you see them today, could be best addressed. So whether it's specifically within your service, whether it's on a, you know, a concrete tailored fix like Dan's previous reference to an injection of additional money, or, you know, Tim's already made the point, as has Kate, about how you develop expertise and readiness and then grow a force if that's needed. So whether it's in terms of a larger force structure, whether it's in terms of more resources for flying or training or maintenance or anything else that's on your mind, or in terms of personnel, trying to find ways to attract and retain more people of excellent capabilities into the service. That may be your answer. Anyway, I'd just like to invite each person to give an example or two for the most serious problems that they've identified of the most practical fixes that we might consider as a country. Starting with you, Mara, if that's okay. Actually, Sam,
I might, because there is one specific follow-on to how in the Army a crisis, a personnel crisis, in the 70s was faced and surmounted and actually has now provided a lasting result. And that is military housing, that is family housing and barracks, was we're in dire straits with a $16 billion budget shortfall, no apparent source of funding, and poor quality results. And it became a readiness issue because people were leaving because of poor housing, believe it or not. That was the primary reason in both recruiting and retention. And so that led to congressional interest, and part of my appointment was to somehow fix that problem. And the fix, 3 years later, was to essentially privatize all of Army family housing and now lodging under the same legislative authorities, not yet barracks, though that should come. And in doing so, achieve three results. One, completely clear that $16 billion backlog of deferred maintenance. That was the mortgaging the future strategy of the day. Second, improve quality to the point where people want to enter these houses, and it now represents 98% of the Army's total family housing stock, now the reach is other types of property. And the third outcome is roughly a 6-to-1 budget multiplier. For every private public dollar invested, there are 6 private dollars, and that has therefore leveraged the budget considerably. Point of this is that the lessons from that experiment, if you will, now writ large are well-known, well-documented, but the department has not accepted the potential for adapting both the principles and the practices into other types of infrastructure. It could, and in the civilian economy, that is being done as we speak in almost every new infrastructure project, some form of public-private partnership, but it's the same principle. So
Very good example. Thank you. Mara.
I'd offer two thoughts about what we do. Number one is the lexicon. We actually have to figure out what we're all talking about, and I think that was pretty clear just in our conversation over the last 45 minutes or so. This is a squishy concept, and there are very high barriers to entry, even for those of us who spend a lot of time thinking about it. So instead, when you open up the newspaper and hear sort of shrill commentary about readiness being apocalyptic, you really need to actually dig down about three different layers. Readiness for whom? For what? What's everyone else doing? All of these really important questions, which aren't necessarily in the interests of those who are probably making the argument, because these invariably have resource implications, right? And I suspect my fellow panelists will, in their sort of list of solutions, in no doubt it will, one of those will be, hey, we want more money. So one is just the lexicon. What are we actually talking about? The second is really forcing a conversation on opportunity costs. So former Deputy Secretary of Defense Bob Work had a great comment in his speech at Johns Hopkins SAIS across the street last week. And he said Secretary Jim Mattis sat down with his leadership team across the department and said, I want all of you to think that we're going to war next week. Now, if you're a combatant commander, that's a little bit discomfiting, because you want everything, and you want it all now. And that's very natural, right? If a conflict breaks out in your area of operations, you want to make sure you have hedged against risks as much as possible. Makes a ton of sense. Now, the challenge, of course, for the Secretary of Defense is to sort of weigh what the opportunity costs are and then decide, is this more important or is that more important? So what I would really like is each week when Secretary of Defense Mattis looks at special deployment orders and thinks through, hey, what should we send and where? I would really like for an important conversation to happen where he says, all right, so what's the opportunity cost? What can't I do? If that conflict next week happens, what does this mean and what are the implications?
Thank you. Excellent. Kate.
Right. Great. I actually do have three specific things. The first is almost... I'll say very tactical, kind of we're facing a bit of an existential budget threat this coming year, mostly because the White House has not decided whether or not to fund the Coast Guard as a military service or as a civilian agency. And it's created a great deal not only of uncertainty, but just real long-term impact as far as our readiness. So just simply acknowledging the Coast Guard as a military service in its entirety, not simply saying, well, it's 20% military and funding it maybe that way, sort of a camel by committee sort of situation, largely because the readiness that we build at home doing our jobs is the same thing that we bring to bear overseas as part of those DoD combatant commands. A good example is I spent a year in the Persian Gulf as the captain of a ship. And our boarding team pretty much came straight from Gloucester, Massachusetts. They'd been doing boardings for 3 years off of New Bedford. And they were by far the best boarding team in the Persian Gulf because they could get on board a fishing boat and talk to fishermen about fish. They knew what they were looking for. We were able to get on and off the boats easily without falling overboard, which sometimes happens when you're doing the boarding. So So the whole Coast Guard is part of that capacity that we bring to bear at these other combatant commands. So it's not a partial thing. It's a whole thing. And then the second part is really breaking out of what we call the curse of Semper Paratus. We had a commandant about 15 years ago who pointed out, maybe it sounds like the Marines have the same problem, where that can-do attitude really gets you in trouble, where we continue to accept mission creep and risk without really communicating it to the public. About 15 years ago, the Coast Guard just essentially tied up all of its counter-narcotics missions and left the boats at the pier for 3 months because we had run out of money. I find it hard to believe that we would ever do that again, but that is sort of the level of risk that we're taking on right now, and it's not really being communicated. And to do that, I think the Coast Guard really needs to try to get some consolidated oversight from Congress. Because we are military and law enforcement and regulatory and part of the intel community, we have something like 15 different committees in Congress that own a piece of the Coast Guard. And this is a DHS problem writ large as well. But as a result, we are a joint problem. And Mara had mentioned, like munitions, if something is joint, everybody appreciates the benefits, but they're very hesitant to really make that the issue that they're going to go to bat for. So the Coast Guard needs somebody to go to bat for it, whether it's on the Hill or even inside the executive branch sometimes. So that's what we need to do. Find a tribe.
Good. Thank you. Tim.
First, Mara, I agree completely. Words do matter. We need to have a common definition. And this is a very difficult field to define a common definition for every user. I think we need to remember we've been a service at war for 16 years, an all-volunteer force who routinely responds to global humanitarian crises across the globe. And all services suffer from what Kate just described as a bias for action. So we don't know how to say no very well. And sometimes I don't know that it's our job to say no. I think we have to lay out risk, resources, and priorities and just make sure that we're articulating back. And I think we're doing that now. I think we've got that capability. You've heard General Milley's testimony. He clearly recognizes the challenge in front of the Army, specifically as a service, to build readiness and then sustain readiness for commitment as the National Command Authority sees fit. We saw the reversal, and this is the first solution. We saw the reversal of our force reductions, bringing us back to 476 this past year, to allow us to man the force to the appropriate manning levels. And then we'll have to see what the future holds based upon priorities established in the Defense Planning Guidance and the National Military Strategy. Do we have the force structure designed to meet future demands? And if we don't, then a decision must be made. And once an informed decision is made based upon risk, then we execute. I think one of the benefits of growing the force, it allows the recovery periods between our workouts, to use a metaphor there, allows us to not burn out the force as fast. And so we have a little bit more flexibility in how we apply military forces. I think we need to use our forces for their intended purpose. And you've seen that in the Army's new effort as we grow our Security Force Assistance Brigades to free up the coin of the realm for the United States Army. That's the Brigade Combat Team. To send a Brigade Combat Team part and parcel to accomplish a mission that the new SFABs could achieve kind of cuts both ways. And so we lose the capability of a Brigade Combat Team, and we also erode readiness. I think we've reversed that. I think we have a good plan in the future. And that structure also allows us to grow the force in a faster fashion should the future environment require that. And I think ultimately, and I know this is a very popular topic, it fills the hallways routinely Monday through Friday here, is the continuing resolutions have to stop. They have to stop because we have to be able to make the long bet. We've got to be able to invest in future modernization and strategy and not bankroll the Army. You know, as I was thinking of a metaphor today, there are people that will fill up their gas tank $5 at a time. And they know they can get to the next gas station, and there are people that can fill it up the entire tank, and they know they can go quite a bit of distance. And so we can make a long bet on the future of our Army as we modernize, as we look to program dollars over multiple fiscal years when we have a budget that's passed without continuing resolutions. And I think that's critical. It will restore confidence all the way from the youngest wrench turner on a tank who doesn't know if he should work his best because the money's not going to be there. He's going to because he's intrinsically motivated to do his best, but he wants to know the money's going to be there when he orders the part, all the way up to our long-term contracts that we have to let so we can modernize and we can grow the Army at the appropriate size.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dan, finally, over to you.
Thanks, Tim. You stole my thunder. But I cannot overestimate how bad CRs are. It just pumps inefficiency into an already inefficient system. So if you want to eliminate waste, just please pass a budget on time. It makes everything harder. That was the CNO's testimony a couple months ago. It just makes it hard. BCA is terrible in the sense that it took money away from us, and everybody on this panel would say we want more money. But I'll take whatever level you're going to give me if you just tell me when, and then you keep your promise. So currently, my peers that are working across the river in the Pentagon are trying to figure out and guess how much money we're going to have on December 9th, because there is no, I'm pessimistic after watching Congress for the last decade, that they will do what they say they did, they're going to do, and pass a budget on time to replace the CR on December 8th. And that means we're back to guessing. It means no new starts on contracts. So Army and Navy, a little bit different. Navy relies a lot on stuff. That means things in the shipyards. That means shipyard workers are going to go on furlough. They're not going to be able to start new contracts. Maintenance availabilities are going to go over, and it's going to cost more. And we're going to lose dollars because Congress can't pass a budget on time. And so how would I fix this, our problem, and I'm the Navy's problem? Pass budgets on time. Just do what you said the Constitution says you're supposed to do. And then then let us be efficient, and we'll get things done. In recent testimony, some ridiculous number of ship availabilities have gone over budget. And part of that, you know, you can point fingers back at the service, but a lot of it is just, we've had 8 straight years of CRs, and they've had to interrupt work and stop. And that's very wasteful. It costs my surface peers days of training when a ship doesn't come out of an availability on time. So CRs. BCA hurts. Giving us less money also hurts. We do need to repair the 277 ships that we have before you buy me 70 more and get me to 350. I'd really just like to get to 277 good ones that are fully trained, manned, and equipped and ready to go.
Yes.
That would be nice. And then to get to Mara's point, ready for what? How about we just release our national security strategy? That would be nice. So what do you want your Navy to do? Do you want us to do forward presence? Okay, then we'll build a Navy to do that, and we'll deploy it that way. Do you want us to do forward presence and be ready for a major conflict? Okay, we'll do that. So right now we're kind of in this uncertain place where we have a national military strategy signed by General Dempsey, a national security strategy from the last administration, and then a lot of talk where you have folks that want to maintain the strategic guidance that really we've been running since World War II. Hey, we're the champions of democracy, and we're out there to ensure that that message is being carried across. Or are we going to retrench, which you hear the other side discuss? I don't know which one is right. I can tell you Congress is voting with their pen, or lack thereof. They want us to retrench based on how they're not passing budgets. It's a, default answer. So that's how I would fix it. If you want me to build a bench, if you want pilots to fly more than 10, 11, 12 hours a month when they're not getting ready to deploy, we need predictable funding streams. Because the first thing to go is the infrastructure and the bench. That's the first thing my bosses are going to cut. If we're going to have to deploy like we've been deploying, then the bench is going to get cut, infrastructure is going to get cut, and then it's just going to be harder to build those units back up when it's their turn. That's all I got.
Thank you, Dan. Okay. Well, let's please include some of your thoughts and questions now. Please wait for a microphone. We'll take 2 or 3 at a time. We'll begin with the woman in the green dress and also Harlan in the first round, and then we'll see where we stand.
Thank you very much. I wanted to add a little bit to the conversation, and that is when we're talking readiness, we cannot overlook the role of the Guard and Reserve, because what's happened is we have increased the role of the Guard and Reserve to work with what is missing out of active duty. And part of what we're seeing right now is there is a lot of drain of experience going on in active duty because we have been on such a constant road of surge. I mean, surge now is our normal routine.
Could you identify yourself? And
Susan Lucas, Reserve Officer Association. So we can't overlook that role and the unfunded requirements, which is growing, and you've talked about that. But particularly with the CR, I want to make a point and then ask a question. So the CR, we also, we don't want a CR, we want the budget, but the CR is staying. And whether we get the CR or the budget, we can't overlook that apportionment is a critical part of it, because now we have a CR that's taken us through the end of December, which is the end of the fiscal, the first quarter. If we're lucky, we get a budget then. Guess what? The services and everybody doesn't get their money right away. It has to apportion from Treasury to the agencies. DOD gets it. Then they apportion it to the services. The Pentagon gets it. Then they sit on a while, apportion it to the commands. They sit on a while and apportion it to the units. So the point is that even with the CR passing in December, there's a good chance that the money won't actually get to the units till the end of the second quarter. So then what happens is the money isn't spent, and then Congress takes it back. So my question is, if we look at things continuing the way they are, as a reform and answer, if we go to a biennial budget, and I realize that it'll never be across the board because of power issues, but if we go to a biennial perspective, what account out of the budget for DOD do you think would best serve the biennial funding from ONN, RDT&E, MILPERS, through from the panel, which where would we place our money if we were able to go biennial, in other words?
Thank you. And before we go to the panel, we'll go to Harlan, please. Second row.
I'm Harlan Ullman. I'd like to thank the panel. An observation and a question for Commander Keeler and one for Colonel Hayden. And then I apologize. I'm going to be forced to leave a little early. It seems to me the two largest threats facing the Department of Defense today are, first, uncontrolled internal real cost growth, about 5 to 7% a year, which is beyond the department's ability. And this goes for everything from people to pencils to precision systems. And unless we spend an additional $30 to $40 to $50 billion a year, we can't even stay even. And second, you discussed a budgetary, regulatory, political process that had to be invented by the KGB because it is so onerous and destructive that I marvel that the Department of Defense really functions as well as it does. And I don't see any chance right now of that changing, barring a crisis. So I think the situation is going to get worse. Having said that, for Commander Keeler, I speak as a former swift boat and destroyer skipper. Having read the Davidson report, to say that I was astounded is understatement. The incompetence and lack of professionalism was extreme. And having to go down to Norfolk to various retirements and changes of command, my sense on the waterfront is that may be much more widespread than we think. And I just wanted to know how bad the situation may well be in the Navy. I mean, that meant yours to answer, but I'd be interested. And for Colonel Hayden, I know what your answer is going to be, but I'm sure with your team, you've envisaged how you might have to take on the equivalent Russian brigade maneuver group, who outgun you, outrange you, probably have better EW than you, have EMP weapons that we don't have, so forth and so on. How do you get ready for that?
Okay, why don't we just work down the row, starting with Dan, since you had a very specific question, and we'll see where the biennial question is addressed along the way.
Right, so on the biennial issue, obviously I would agree, well above my pay grade to fix. In the Navy, the reserve issue is a little less apparent. It's more of an Army Air Guard. Obviously, the Navy, we augment with reserve, but we don't have full reserve units with the exception of a couple squadrons. But I would agree, the more we lean on them, the more they get used up, and it's another readiness issue. On your comment on the surface Navy, so a lot of helicopter pilots actually end up spending a tour in ship's company. I have an OD letter. I've been a ship driver for 2 years. And the concerns that were raised in that report are frustrating to people like me who cross over and work with the Service Navy, because we've been pointing these things out. And the Service Navy has very good examples in the line, in aviation and in submarines, about how to grow officers in a very specific and tailored way to ensure you get professionalism very early. Like, you know, you get your wings, you're the best commercial pilot you're ever going to be. You study so hard for 2 years. We've been asking the Service Navy to consider that for a long time. So, unfortunately, not a surprise. And I would agree with you that there are some issues. And there, you know, if you read the same articles I do, you've heard this, you know, efficiency over effectiveness. So we became very budget conscious as a Navy from 2001 and through about 2010. Even the SWO in a box, the CD-ROM training, way too much over-reliance on the job training. And that's just part of the Surface Navy's culture. I didn't, you know, different culture in aviation, so I didn't agree with it. But I think you'll see that change now. So that's very clear in Admiral Davidson's report that they're going that direction. So, yes, I think you have a generation of surface warfare officers who did not get the training that I think the public thinks would, you know, is happening. And it was a budgetary efficiency decision. And now we're going to say, they started correcting it in 2010. They got rid of the CD-ROMs. They brought back the classroom stuff. But I think you'll see it grow. So, yeah, I share your concerns.
Tim.
So no easy questions today. So I agree the uncontrolled costs, and there's nothing that I can do about it. The technological challenges that we see in peer and near-peer competitors, it's not the first time we've been here. Maybe in the technological, but in the volume. So under the Army that I watched growing up, as a kid in Europe, the old airland battle, fight outnumbered and win. So the reason why we had our big five systems developed was to fight outnumber and win. The M1A1 tank at the time, or M1 tank, to be able to absorb frontal hull shots and defeat a superior, not necessarily technology, but number of Russian tanks in the Fulda Gap. So I think what we do is we start we've been here before, number one, and we were able to achieve the readiness and the training proficiency that we have and the confidence that we can do our mission. Second, we've got to study history. There's not an armor officer, there's not a mechanized leader or a light infantryman that's not studying what's going on in Ukraine right now. We're studying this intimately. We've transitioned from airland battle, as the old way that we would fight, outnumbered to win, to the Army operating concept, win in a complex world, that allows us to redefine the fight, and then now we are embracing multi-domain battle, bringing all of our systems to bear. Now, there's a lot of technology that has to work. You mentioned EMP. If a light switch goes off and everything doesn't work, at the end of the day, what I can control is that my infantrymen, my tankers, my cannoneers, my sustainers, they're masters of their craft. So we know how to disperse. We know how to execute good mission-type orders. We're far more lethal, and we are more honed in our tradecraft because we've practiced it more. And so, you know, effectively, we've got to be faster. We've got to be leaner. We've got to be more lethal in everything we do to achieve that position of relative advantage, and then appreciate the fact, and this is one of the components of the armor operating concept, is that position of advantage is only relative for a very short period of time. And if we sit on our laurels and we don't recognize the shifts, then we're going to be caught short. But if we can continue to watch and learn and adapt, then I think we've got what we need to accomplish what you just described. Yeah, there is a technology solution to it, but it's not the only solution, and there's no silver bullet.
Does anybody at the end of the panel want to take the biennial question, or shall we just move on to the next round?
Sure, I'll offer quick comments on both. First of all, on your points on the Guard and Reserve, you know, General Milley gets real credit, I think, because he consistently says total force. Right? Today's U.S. Army is bigger than 1 million soldiers. Right? And that is a comment you hear from him time and time again, and that's really important. The Air Force has done very well in terms of integration, as you no doubt know. Army, I think, is making important steps. On the biannual, I love the idea as a wonk. It's just never going to happen. I don't see any evidence why Congress would actually ever permit it, which is so unfortunate. It gets at the issue that I think Dan was making a few minutes ago. You know, almost any of us in the defense world would take a smaller budget on time. That's nice in theory. It's also not what we're being handed. And finally, just on the Russia piece, you know, Tim is spot on. We are spending a ton of time focused on it. I used to joke that I would know we were doing better when people didn't accidentally say Soviet each week than Russian. And I think we are starting to make some important progress on that. It's important to note that the U.S. Defense world has spent time thinking about what a potential conflict with China would look like. And there's actually more complementarity to that, to a Russia fight, than not. So we have a lot to think about, but we're not as far behind as one might assume.
By the way, before we go to the next round in the hall or in the room, I wanted to give our Marine aviator in the audience a chance to quickly respond on the state of Marine aviation. He's another one of our military fellows. We're saving him for a future event on stage, but I think he may have an important voice to add here. So, Sniper, over to you. His nickname is Sniper, but he's actually a helicopter pilot.
So. Yeah, it was not, some may think it wasn't as well learned as some may think. But to your point about Marine Aviation, General Rutter just spoke on the Hill on Thursday. And Marine Aviation has had its challenges over the last couple of years. However, we're also going through a massive transition. As you know, we're moving all of our airframes to a newer airframe. Part of the challenge we had, especially with the MV-22, is very popular airframe, but brought it into service, immediately deployed with it. We talk about the 53 Echo, workhorse of the Marine Corps, trying to reset that again. There's a perception that although we're no longer in OIF or OEF, our op tempo has not slowed down, especially in Marine aviation. So we continue to have guys come home, and Tim kind of talked about deployment time to dwell time. We're at a 1 to 2 in Marine aviation. Actually, 1 to 2.6 is what General Rutter briefs, which means as opposed to being 6 months deployed, 12 months home, now we're 15 months home, which is a little bit better. But the same challenges persist. I think coming out of General Rutter's comments, things are getting better, but it's going to take massive amounts of time. It's going to take, as everyone has already stated, a predictable, on-time budget. And then to your point about infrastructure, we have the Commandant has made the same statement that he looks at infrastructure as a strategic platform for projection of power. And I think we're trying to get our hands around that with respect to how to have the correct size of infrastructure to support the force. So we are in the process. I say we, the Marine Corps, is in the process, but it does in the process of improving and getting better to meet today's challenges and to look at tomorrow's challenges. And all of that is going to take time and money, predictable money. So I'll stop there unless there's specific questions.
That's great. I'm also going to ask that Ivory, if he may, he's our Air Force fellow, may want to speak very briefly about his services readiness, since that's also been a topic of discussion today.
Thanks, Mike. I'm a cyber guy in the Air Force. So Ivory Card, I've been in the Air Force for about 27 years. But to your readiness point about how the Air Force sees it, readiness is something that we've been dealing with for years and years. We've got a pilot shortage, and we're continuing to battle that. We're doing various things to try to bring retired pilots back to bigger Air Force to kind of deal with that readiness issue that we have. So that's a huge problem for us today. But to your point about the total force, the Air Force, Secretary Wilson and General Goldfein are totally dialed in on the total force. So that total piece is a key cog for the Air Force to do what we do going forward. We have recognized that the active force cannot be as effective as we need to be, as we used to be in the past. We have got to include our Guard and Reserve friends. So we've been able to do that very successfully at the squadron group and the wing level at all of our bases. And our strategy definitely includes it. None of our strategy is written such that the active force can do the job. We have to include the total force. So that is a huge part of what the Air Force does. But readiness is something that we have been dealing with. And to your point, we've been dealing with it for a very long time. So what's starting to manifest now is something that the Air Force has known for a while. So readiness is something that we hopefully, that is getting better, but it'll take a whole lot longer, I think, for the Air Force to get there than I think some of the other services. So with that mic. Back to you.
Thank you. Okay, to you all. Other questions? We've got time. We've got about 12 more minutes left. Anybody in the audience still have a question? Yes, sir. We've got one here, and then I'll take a couple more if there are two more, and then we'll maybe just have one final round to wrap.
My name is Bayo Adedeji. I'm with the Congressional Budget Office. And question I have, I think, relates to a budget, but let me start by saying that assuming we are talking about near-term readiness of the units to do what their mission is. You know, I know the Army, you are doing the sustained readiness model now, and before you used to do the Alpha Gem model, and same thing with the Navy, you guys have your deployment system.
OFRP, yeah.
Yeah, you deploy around the world. But from the point of view of the public, those units have a identified mission that they are set up for and that they are trained for. And if you look at the budget of the DOD, for the last several years, the base budget total has been going up, and also the training budget hasn't really declined. So it's difficult for a general public person to understand why there are claims of readiness problems, given the fact that your training budget hasn't gone down. Maybe it's a definitional issue as well, but the specific question that I have for you is that are there other things, namely maybe a implementation issue with the services that makes near-term unit readiness difficult to achieve?
Thank you. And then we'll take this question here as well.
Hi, my name is John Baer. I'm conducting research here in Washington concerning Russian grand strategy and potential United States responses to that grand strategy. I have a question really for all of the panelists regarding civilian-military relations. Particularly, I really appreciated your comments regarding the public and private sectors and their relations with the military. It seems to me that it's extremely difficult to really make these issues resonate with the public, and particularly with our leaders, in such a way that we can overcome these political issues and partisan problems with regards to funding our military properly and making sure that our readiness is no longer a monetary issue. And I just would like to, I would like it if any of the panelists could offer their thoughts regarding what we can do to break down these political barriers and really just make this a universal non-issue.
Okay, was there one final question as well, and then we'll wrap up here on stage. Yes, ma'am. This will be our last one.
Hi. My name is Ashley Roki, and I'm with Shepherd Media. Just a quick question about your thoughts on the Army's new modernization command, how that could possibly help moving forward, and if the other services could glean lessons for that if it comes to fruition.
Great. Okay, so we're just going to work our way down the row. I'm just going to offer one very brief point to my CBO brethren, because I used to work there too. And when I was there, one of our colleagues wrote this amazing study. It didn't have a particularly glitzy or glamorous title, but it's still one of my favorite defense publications of all time. I think it was called Measuring Military Readiness, Trends and Selected Indicators 1980 to 1994. And you can actually Google this. It was written recently enough that it made it onto the web.
He gave me a copy. He's so proud of it.
I didn't write it, but I am proud of it because my colleague wrote it. And when she wrote it, the reason she stopped in 1994, I believe, and the reason there's been no sequel of quite the same level of detail is because a lot of the information has subsequently been classified, which I consider unnecessary classification in almost all instances. There may be occasional moments when there's some crucial system that you have a particular shortfall of or a particular maintenance, you know, breakdown about, and you just don't want the enemy to know. But in general, this information is much more usefully seen as grist for a broader debate about readiness and where to make specific fixes and where things actually aren't so bad. And therefore, this kind of data, at sort of the unit by unit and also the category of equipment by category level, I think should be declassified. When the services just come out and say, oh, this unit is broken, or we only have 3 out of 58 brigades that are ready, and they and they sort of cherry-pick data, they fall into the trap that Columbia professor Richard Betts warned about in his book on military readiness when he had chapter 6, I think, the title is Lies, Damned Lies, and Readiness Statistics. And it's just too easy to play games, political and otherwise, with this kind of information, unless we have it all out there. Also, one last thing in my little tirade, then I'll be done for the day, you'll be glad to know. C ratings are almost useless. C rating is the comprehensive, subjective commander's indicator of what he thinks his unit is, 1, 2, 3, or 4.
We make them up.
Not quite that bad, but there is so much subjectivity and lack of transparency into how those indicators are constructed that it raises more questions than it answers ultimately for me. So anyway, thank you for your patience on that, and now we'll work our way down the road.
I should take it back. We don't make them up, but we are allowed to provide input at the end. So there's some very numbers-based data, and then we can make our commander's assessment. The CBO question, thank you, sir. I've been reading your reports for 2 months, or your offices, along with GAO. They're really a public treasure, so thank you for you and your peers for everything that you do. The question about how can the training line stay the same, and then we come back and say, well, we're not getting the same bang for our buck. The same training dollar doesn't get us the same readiness. Well, some of it goes to what the gentleman up here talked about, where our cost for everything, for I'm still not exactly sure why, but they are growing faster than the pace of inflation. So my dollar in defense does not buy the same dollar that you have out in the public sector. And that is one problem. The second problem is we've been playing this shell game that I kind of described before. We've been robbing from operations and training to from maintenance to pay for operations and training. What happens is, and I'm glad I wrote the stat down because now I get to use it. In October of this year, only half of the total inventory of the 542 Strike Fighters or Super Hornets were fully mission capable. That means they could fly. So you only have half of your Super Hornets that can fly. Most of those Super Hornets are going to deployed units. We're robbing them from the training squadrons and the at-home units to deploy them. That means the unit at home only has one or two jets to train with. They can't even execute their training budget because they don't have anything to train with. And that's been going on for a while. So when you steal spare parts and mechanics and you cannibalize your at-home, your bench, to deploy them, your bench can't train anymore. Not because they don't want to, or they don't have the money to in some cases, but they don't have the assets. They don't have the mechanics. Admiral Shoemaker on Friday at the HAS testified, and this is new, this wasn't happening even when I was there. We have strike fighter squadrons in Lemoore that are only operating one maintenance shift. So they only normally were manned to have two maintenance shifts. Basically, you can run maintenance for about 18 to 20 hours in a day. Lemoore has stolen so many mechanics from their non-deployed units to deploy that they can't do that anymore. As a former CO of a squadron, that would ground you to a halt like that. You couldn't do the phase maintenance on your fighters. You just couldn't do it. You would not be able to execute your training budget, even if you wanted to. So that's a big problem. And that is, in aviation-wise, that's probably why you'll see, you know, us asking for more money. It's not for the training, it's to feed the maintenance shell game that we've been playing for 8 years.
Thank you. Tim, for whichever question
so
specifically.
I'd like to quickly touch both questions. Sir, your question is exceptional. How do we communicate to our constituents on why we have a budget, but then we continue to ask for more when we say we're trained? Well, if you train a brigade combat team to do its warfighting mission, its 5 directed mission essential tasks, and then you take that brigade combat team and you send it somewhere else where it only touches some of them or does not get the opportunity to continue to hone those skills, there is a cost imposed, because as you bring those soldiers, those formations back, they really have to, in some regards, relearn. As a young officer, our mid-grade non-commissioned officers would routinely have 20 to 30 gunneries under their belt. And so that's about twice a year, sometimes 3 times a year. Now in some of the formations, as far back as 3 or 4 years ago, some of our mid-grade leaders would just have a handful. And in my particular case, where as a battalion commander, brigade commander, when I had more gunneries than our seasoned non-commissioned officers who stayed in the trenches their entire career, there was a mismatch. We've reversed a good bit of that. We've corrected a lot of our training resource models to allow us to forecast that. The opportunity to go and continue to hone our skills while deployed in the armor community and the mech infantry community's particular sense is incredible. So I think, I'm optimistic, I think we'll kind of see a narrowing of that gap, and that'll allow us to accurately communicate the narrative. But I think we all owe it to be able to answer that question. It is easier to maintain a level of readiness, even if it's less, some number less than 100, if we want to use 100 as a top scale, than to do a cycle of violence to go up and down. It actually takes more resources to get back to an acceptable level of readiness. So thank you for your question. The modernization command, I think it's brilliant. I think the fact that there's, you know, you put command, and words matter, you hold someone accountable for making sure that we've got a leader who's touching the problem, who's looking and who's asking the hard questions, is absolutely critical. So I know that the one of the Army's top four, at least two of them are touching that problem daily. They are personally shepherding this modernization command that's coming up. They've got the portfolios, the six portfolios, where they're doing a one-to-end analysis, so we can correctly frame the problem. Now, what the Army has to do is we've got to make sure that we tell our narrative correctly. Mm-hmm. You can listen to any testimony, and the first thing that'll come out is, you know, well, you know, we've got Future Combat System, we've got the Comanche. So we have not necessarily covered ourselves in glory in the past two decades on Army acquisition. But I think we've addressed it. I think the correct, from my perspective, having listened to it communicated to me, it makes perfect sense. And I think what we'll see is our ability to clearly articulate our emerging requirements back to the defense industry, back to Congress, and more importantly, this is in partnership with Congress. I know the Army leadership has gone to Congress early on this. There are going to be no surprises here because nobody likes surprises on the Hill. And so there is support for this process as we move forward. They have assigned the right senior leaders to own these portfolios, and they owe feedback to the Chief of Staff of the Army just after the new year on where we're at and how we should continue to move forward. So, again, to summarize, clearly articulate our requirements, hold a commander responsible for those requirements, and then communicate early and often, and don't allow ourselves to go too far down the road of something we may or may not need in the future.
Thank you. Kate.
All right. Great. All really excellent questions, but I'm going to stick with a little bit of the training and then mostly Civ Mil, which is a big place. It's where the Coast Guard lives, to be honest with you. As far as training goes, Coast Guard has a very different training model, but I can say that the CR piece, which I know Dan has really written about at length, is a big thing. It's not just how much, it's when. So if you don't have that money at the beginning of the year, what happens is people who need the training don't get it because training money will essentially be slashed until we know how much we have. And then at the end of the year, suddenly people are going to, you know, maybe high-end tactical classes that they don't really need, but they might need later, and you miss out on some of the basics. So that's just yet another impact of the CR. Civ Mil is something that the Coast Guard really has baked into its DNA. A lot of national security professionals have talked about economic readiness and economic strength as the bedrock for our Defense Department and our national security enterprise. So the Coast Guard partners very closely with our international partners, things like shipping companies like Maersk, the port operators of Virginia, international ports. We have folks who are attached to embassies in China, places where there really aren't even other DOD personnel who are actively engaged with the civilian commercial enterprise, supporting $4 trillion a year in economic activity in the United States that's driven through these ports and keeping that safe and secure so it can fund this really impressive national security enterprise, but also as a source of information and partnership. The other place where we really do engage are international forums. So the Coast Guard is America's representative at the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, as well as engaging with things like the Arctic Council, the Pacific Coast Guard Council, which is really a working level way for us to engage with the Chinese Coast Guard, the Chinese Navy, the Russian maritime forces in a way that, I mean, we're not naive about it. We don't think we're going to be best friends, but it is an outlet that gives us an opportunity to engage. And then the entire Western Hemisphere is a place where we engage very heavily with civilian governments to try to produce stability and rule of law to kind of decrease the flow coming towards the United States. As far as we're concerned, the border is about 1,500 miles away. So that's where we try to start.
Thank you. Mark.
All
I'll take the last two questions in opposite order. So Army Modernization Command, I am so curious to see what happens with this. The big question will be, does it affect the money? And if it does, Army Modernization Command will have succeeded. And if it doesn't, it will have been just a shell. I think, you know, there are opportunity costs, and a very superficial way of thinking about it is balancing amongst capability, capacity, and readiness. That is flawed and imperfect, but it is what it is. And the Army's numbers, the Army's capacity probably would need to go down a little bit for there to be more serious investment in capability and in modernization. I think there's a lot of us who would really like to see that. So let's see what happens. Let's see what happens with the next budget submission. If we see a real focus on Army leadership that is ready to seriously consider what those future conflicts look like by modernizing the force, which it really needs after the last 16 years in all sorts of ways, hey, that's terrific. And, you know, I think there'll be a lot of advocates there. On the civil mill question, you know, if you haven't read it, you need to read Warriors and Citizens, the Corey Shockey, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis book about this gap between the American public and the U.S. military. We've never had so few people serving for so long with so little attention and effectively disinterest at home. Until we find a way in America to start having that conversation, again, I think all of our comments, all of our screeching on the Hill saying we need more money and here's why, et cetera, I think it will all be for naught.
And Sandy.
Thank you. And thank you for being here and your attention. There are three specific changes that affect the way in which both the budget and I think the institution, the enterprise, run that would make a profound difference, all of which have been implemented in the private sector in the last 30 years. First, that every investment in a infrastructure installation facility be measured on a life cycle basis, not a annual or simply construction basis. We don't do that, and when you do it, and it is best practice in the private sector, when it's done, it changes the decision more often than not, because it proves how much worth there is going to be in that commitment. Second, for every cost, there is a value. We, that is, institutionally don't reveal those values. CBO doesn't do it, GAO doesn't do it, the department doesn't do it. When it is done, and people begin to understand, both on the Hill and generally, that this is a $1.5 trillion portfolio, that is the infrastructure part of defense, and it may be twice that. We simply don't know. That covers about 60% of the assets that have been counted. When market value is introduced to the cost equation, then that at least sheds light on whether the cost is worth it or not. And it provokes a debate which is now rarely had. And finally, the word requirement in terms of lexicon, to me, is one of the most dangerous words in the entire vocabulary. Because by its nature and by definition, it implies just that. We require you, the contractor, the private sector, or anyone else, to meet our definition of the problem and the need, as opposed to the market economy, which never starts with requirements, always starts with needs and definitions of needs, measures of needs, and then works back to what is required to meet those needs. It is not simply a semantic difference, in my view. It's a profound philosophical difference. So change three words, and we may change the institution.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for being here, and please join me in thanking the panelists.